The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 946. It's the 11th of December 2017. On the podcast today, I have Dennis Thomas, CEO, and Richard Wilkins, CFO of Phoenix Global Mining. That's PGM ticker there. And the guys talks about the 70% increase in their Empire Mine land position and the extension of their exploration area. Plus, I also have Dr. Vladislav Sandler, CEO and co-founder of recently listed biotech company Hemogenix Pharmaceuticals. That's H-E-M-O ticker. And Vladislav explains what they do and their strategy going forward. Also on the podcast, Christian Dennis, Chief Executive Officer and Head of Corporate Broking at Optiva Securities, discusses the following stocks: Asia Met Resources, Ortac Resources, United Oil and Gas, and Upland Resources. Also on the podcast, as of Monday, I have Connor. It's Connor Campbell, of course, from Spreadex, market analyst there. And Connor talks about companies releasing news this week, including Dixon's Carphone Warehouse, Purple Bricks, and Sports Direct.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dennis Thomas, Chief Executive Officer, and Richard Wilkins, Chief Financial Officer of Phoenix Global Mining. That's PGM ticker. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Nice to be with you, Justin.
Yeah. Thank you, Justin. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you. And we've got an update, and we'll go through that in a bit. A significant bit of news there you've released, and we'll go into detail of that in a bit. But before we do, as always, for people new to the podcast, just switched on, or new to investing, could you give a brief summary of what Phoenix Global Mining is all about, please, guys?
Certainly, Justin. Well, we are redeveloping the historic Empire copper, gold, silver, tungsten zinc mine in Idaho in the United States. We listed the company on AIM in June, and we are basically going through the work program that we set out at that time, and it's all going very much according to plan. Essentially, it's two projects on the same ore body, on the same hill or mountainside, obviously. Phase one is to put an open pit project into production as quickly as possible, and we're looking at 7,000 tons of cathode copper from 2020 onwards to generate cash flow, etc. And phase two, which is running concurrently with phase one, is to get into the potentially enormous underground ore system, which was in fact historically mined. And the recent announcement we've just made is very much in respect to phase two. Phase one is going according to plan. Dennis did a podcast not long ago where we announced a significant increase in contained metal on the phase one open pit metal content. But this announcement is all about phase two, and I'll let Dennis explain it.
Okay, yes, Dennis. And so this is at 70% increase in Empire Mine land position and extension of exploration area. So take us through why you've done this, Dennis, and also the details of what's there.
Yes, well, Justin, we've basically the Empire ore body is running from south to north. We have, of that particular skarn system, our consulting geologist estimates that probably less than 5% of the entire ore body, the ore system, in fact, has been explored to date. And this really is, in fact, expanding, if you like, our knowledge of the ore system. Mm-hmm. We have on our particular land holding between 50 and 150 meters wide, averaging 100 meters, what we call a skarn deposit, a metamorphic deposit, which is steeply dipping. And this disappears off to the north, out of our land position. We have of that we have about 1.7 kilometers of which the open pit that where the resources have been declared with Richard occupies about a kilometer of that. We've about 0.7 of a kilometer going north from that, and then this disappears onto what they call the horseshoe block, There was an old mine called the Horseshoe Mine. And what we've done is, in fact, we've acquired a further 33 claims or 564 acres around the previously producing mine on long strike. So effectively, we've increased our, if you like, our strike length from about 1.7 kilometres to nearly 3 kilometres. Very exciting because the Horseshoe Mine was predominantly a lead zinc mine, but was finally producing copper at depth, very similar to the Empire, very similar to the Empire system, the same skarn system, and it's an exciting development as far as we're concerned. So our footprint is basically now 70% greater, from 819 acres to a total land package now of 1,383. Contiguous acres. In other words, it's a bit like having a, how could I say it, if you've got a vein in your garden and it runs into the next door garden. Well, we've actually acquired the next door garden.
Got it, yeah. And well, the dogs are excited anyway. And
they are indeed. Well, I think that's because I'm about to mention the grades.
Okay, go for it.
I mean, the horseshoe mine was producing copper grading 3.8% and zinc at 12%. So when I mention that, the dogs do get excited and they start barking.
Yeah. Okay, guys. So what's... I mean, ultimately, like I said, the first phase here is to produce 7,000 tonnes per annum by 2020. So what's the ultimate ambition here?
Well, the ultimate ambition on phase one with the oxides is to continue the exploration of the oxides into the Horseshoe Block. So, if you like, the open pit potential has now become considerably greater, the resource potential, because we've got an extra 1.2, 1.3 kilometres of, if you like, oxide material to explore. And we know we can see from evidence, surface evidence, that the ore body carries on to the north. It's with phase two, of course, we're presently, we've been drilling into the sulfides, and we're presently looking to open the open at two levels, the 700 level and the 1100 level, to gain access into the sulfide ore body. And obviously, with the Horseshoe Mine, the potential at depth is exactly the same as the Empire Mine.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Well, they are very excited by that. I suppose we've got two dogs. They egg each other on, don't they?
Yes. I think there's a delivery. That's the problem.
Yeah.
I think he's probably eaten the delivery man. I shouldn't be surprised.
He sounds that excited. Excellent, guys. Well, listen. I mean, you know, copper's a very exciting commodity. It always has been, but I mean, especially going forward. So if people are listening to this now and like the sound of this plan, the strategy, but are not yet following the story on Vox Markets, give us three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page, please.
Well, Justin, I think we should just repeat what we've said before. Mm-hmm. It's a fairly simple story here. I think we are in the right metals, probably at the right time, and very much in the right jurisdiction. This is Idaho. It's the United States. It's a wonderful place to be working. It's stable. It's secure. We're in copper, cobalt, and these are metals that I think the world is recognizing are desirable. So we're in the right metals at the right time, in the right place, and if I may say so, I think we've got the right team to develop this and make a success of it, both phase one and phase two.
Absolutely agree.
Excellent, guys. Good to chat to you, and let's hopefully speak again soon, because you've got a lot going on there. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot, Justin.
Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dr. Vladislav Sandler, CEO and co-founder of Hemogenics Pharmaceuticals. That's H-E-M-O. Vladislav, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, I assume a lot of people may not have heard of the company because you're newly listed. I know you've had some good coverage already due to a collaboration with a certain university, which we'll get to in a bit. But for people who've not heard of you, Vladislav, can you explain what Hemogenics Pharmaceuticals is all about, please?
Hemogenics is a biopharmaceutical company that is trying to change the way bone marrow transplants are being done. Bone marrow transplants are very difficult procedures that are given to people who usually suffer from blood cancers, like leukemias, lymphomas, multiple myelomas, and others. So a typical bone marrow transplant consists of two phases. Phase one, that's the phase when you have to prepare a patient for the transplantation. And phase two, when you actually give new cells to that patient. So both phases are dangerous and have severe limitations. So Hemogenix Pharmaceuticals is trying to change the way both of these phases are done and make bone marrow transplants safer and more efficient.
Excellent. Okay, well, listen, this is quite technical, so I'm going to ask you some stupid questions because I'm not obviously an expert in this field. But I like the sound of this because, you know, we often hear of bone marrow transplants. I didn't realize there's an issue with it. So at the moment, what is the problem with the way it's done, bone marrow transplants?
So the major problem in preparation of patients or conditioning of the patients for the bone marrow transplant is that it's done today by giving these patients a cocktail of chemotherapy and radiation. Both chemotherapy and radiation are very nonspecific, very toxic, and very detrimental to the health of these patients. And because of that, not that many patients can go through the procedure itself, to get a bone marrow transplant. So we're trying to change this situation by developing a new class of bispecific antibodies that we call CDX antibodies. So these antibodies redirect immune cells of the patient to attack and eliminate unwanted cells. And these antibodies are very specific and they do not touch any other type of cells in the patient's body. And hence, the side effects of this treatment are going to be minimal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see. So I understand you're going to improve this process by a lot. But is there anyone else doing this at the moment?
Well, there is one publicly traded company that is trying to develop a similar conditioning product. They're trying to develop it for quite a while, and they're using a technology that was developed a long time ago, and basically they're trying to use antibodies that are linked to radioactive isotope, and by definition, this antibody this treatment is not very specific simply because they still use radiation. And it's also dangerous and it's very difficult to administer.
Okay, so it's not really a similar kind of process to yours, really, is it?
No, we have a very, much more advanced technology that is, it belongs to the class of bispecific antibodies and immune therapy.
Okay, so far you're ticking a lot of boxes here because you're solving a problem. There's not a competitor, it seems, who are not aligned with yours, any of the technology. And thirdly, right, the size of the market here. So what's the potential for this market then, Vladislav?
Well, the market for bone marrow transplants, both in US and Europe combined, is about $8 to $9 billion a year. So because we are developing treatments that will allow a larger number of people go through the bone marrow transplant simply because it's safer and is not that detrimental to the health of these people, we expect to expand the market significantly. Our estimate will be able to expand this market by 30 to 50%.
Wow. And so... let's get on to the bit of news you've already released, and I see you're covered in the Daily Mail small cap section, and this is around this collaboration you've done. So you've had a collaboration with Oxford University. Can you take us through why this is significant and why what you're doing with Oxford University?
Well, with Oxford University, we are trying to understand if a certain class of biologics that Oxford developed is capable to convert blood stem cells from the state of dormancy to the state of readiness to go and regenerate entire blood system. So for us, it's very important because if these research works, and we truly see that this type of biologics convert, you know, does the job that we think it should do. We will have new venues opening for us, and probably a new product to develop.
Okay, all right. So this is a separate sort of thing to what you're doing at the moment. So that's good. So as far as you know, the bone marrow transplants are concerned, and the new technology you have here, I mean, what are the chances of success? How far along are you in testing this, and how do you know if it's going to work?
Well, we know for both of our product candidates, we have a proof of principle, and in both product candidates, we tested them in humanized animals. So we know that they work in live animals with human blood. So everything was tested on human cells. So this is pretty much as close as one can possibly get before testing it in real patients.
Yeah.
So our next step is to go into clinical trials, and we are going through the formal preclinical development and through the pre-IND consultation program with the FDA. With a goal to file an IND and go into clinical trials within the next 16 months.
I understand. All right, so that's... and is that the next sort of big milestone or big bit of news people can expect from you?
No, we'll start publishing our results, and we filed a number of patent applications that I expect to be... judged and approved. And we will also release additional news on the preclinical development.
Excellent stuff. Well, Vladislav, good to chat to you. And if someone else is listening to this and they're as interested in this as I am, and but they're not yet following you on Vox Markets, could you give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page to follow the story and add you to their watch list?
Well, reason number one, our science is solid and we have a proof of principle. We know our technology works. Mm-hmm. Reason number two, we're nimble, we're moving very fast, and we know where we're going to. This, in addition to our science, gives us an edge. And number three, we have the support of experienced and world-renowned experts who believe in what we're doing.
Excellent. Vladislav, good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Christian Dennis, Chief Executive and Head of Corporate Broking at Optiva Securities. Christian, thanks for coming back on.
Yeah, hi, Justin. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, but do you know what? It's been almost a year. We can't... we've got to make this more regular. It's a ridiculous. A year ago.
No, absolutely. It's been quite a busy year. I think the last time I was on, I was talking to you about Talao and how we were optimistic about what they were going to do, and they went on and did very well, actually. So that was well worthwhile coming on at the time. But
yeah,
I haven't spoken to you since, I don't think.
Exactly. I thought, have I offended the guy or what? But there we are. At least you're back on now. So obviously I haven't. But I mean, you've done very well this year. And because I do watch some of your stocks, and I always see your name at the bottom of RNSs on some of the stocks doing very well. And so let's go through some of those. I know, first and foremost, a very popular one, which you chatted about before, and I do hold stock in it. Asia Met has done very well this year, hasn't it?
It has done. I mean, it's, you know, the classic company with a good management team. They've got a good project, and it's all about execution. And these guys, they know how to execute. And I think it's just given investors more and more confidence during the course of the year as they've gone through their development plan. And the results are actually coming out better than would have expected, and the peripheral exploration that they're doing around the main BKM project has come up with some really excellent results, and it looks like they've got another potential project up there. So that's been good, and there's more to come because they've still got they're still awaiting the license approval for Butong, which is the big copper porphyry up in Sumatra, and once they get that through, then they're ready to get a drill rig up there and start to do some work on that. I mean, and that is a much bigger asset than the BKM project. So I think investors should be looking forward to exciting times going into 2018 with Asia Met again. That's been very good, actually.
Absolutely. So even though they've risen quite well, I think they've done about sort of almost a 10 bagger, I think, about 8 bagger, I think, isn't it? But it's still more to come.
At one point, we did the first financing at 1.2p, May 2015, and I think the shares changed hands over 12p a few weeks ago, so it was actually a 10-bagger, which was excellent. I mean, I always say, don't look at where a share has gone percentage-wise, you know, look at what's the underlying value of the company, and if it's gone up 100%, don't say, well, it's gone up 100%, I'm going to take my profits. Mm. If it's gone up 100% because they've added 200% of value, then you just got to hang on. And we've still got some big MPV values on AsiaMet, and they're nothing like up to that yet. So we don't see why investors should be exiting at this stage at all.
Of course. And copper, it's an exciting story. So let's go through some other stocks. What else do you?
One that we're not brokers to the company yet, but we have been helping them out a little bit, and that is Ortac Resources, and this sort of fits into our sort of value play. We had a close look at it, and Phil Swinford, our analyst, did a very comprehensive note on the company, and he came up with a 9p share price value, looking at all the assets that they've got there, so we put £1 million in a 3p, which is a little bit lower than that now, and then we did pretty much all of the £1.7 million financing at 2p, and you know that gave them the ability to then go and talk to Casa Mining, where they have an interest in that gold project that they own in the DRC, and go and talk to them about basically rolling that whole Casa Mining business into Ortac, which is which they've agreed, and it's all going through now, and that gives them a very attractive gold asset. I mean, there's over 1 million ounces in JORC'd there. The drilling program at the moment's been coming up with some great results. I mean, they came up with the best ever results, got 24.75 meters at 8 grams per ton and 5 meters there at 22. So they're all quite excited about where they think that resource will go, and I think they're pretty comfortable that they'll get to 2 million ounces. Mm. And when you think that Ortac's got a market cap of $10 million at the moment, so they've got that asset in there. They've also got the Slovakian asset, which has got over a million ounces of gold in it. They've got an interest in Zamsort, which is a Zambian copper cobalt play, and everyone's going nuts about cobalt at the moment, and people, I don't think, really picked up on the fact that Zamsort has sitting on a huge exploration ground in Zambia, and that has got some pretty good cobalt on it. So I think further down the line, when that starts to get a bit more airtime, people might start to put some value in on that as well. So I'm hoping going into next year that Ortac will look to move the gold project in the DRC through the development curve and start talking about doing a scoping study or a PEA on that, and then we can start to put a few numbers around a project. And I think the Phil's research, he came up with an MPV on that gold project based on 100,000 ounces a year. He came up with $171 million MPV. So you can see where that could go as they move that project along. So I quite like Ortac. You know, we have got some shares. I'll disclose an interest in the shares there, because we do like it, and that'd be one of my top picks for 2018, for sure, actually.
Yeah, well, I've had Nick von Schunding on the podcast a couple of times, and he seems like he knows what his strategy is there, and he's going towards.
No, he's good. No, he's a good guy. I mean, it's good to have him on board. He knows what he's doing. I think they are going to start going places now.
Cool.
And you look at some of the other companies on the market with not much in the way of assets, you know, with much higher market caps than Ortac, and I scratch my head really why they're still down where they are, and I think it's just legacy issues of the underperformance over the last few years. But as that subsides, then I think the market will start to give them more and more value.
History, yeah. Okay, Sortac and Ishmet. Anything else?
United Oil and Gas. We're very happy about the way that's gone. We did the reverse takeover earlier this year at 2.5p. Mm-hmm. Brian Larkin and Jonathan Leather, I mean, they said at the time with their relationships with Tullow, they thought they could potentially get some deals done, and they've just announced the deal with Tullow on their Jamaican prospects, and they're going to be doing some seismic on that, and then they're looking to drill a well into that in 2019. I mean, and that is just a huge target. Barney Gray's put an exploration value around that of $600 million, and they've farmed in for no premium. There's $20 million spent on that prospect already, and they farmed in for no premium for a 20% interest. And if it was to come in as a successful well in 2019, this is it's a multiple play system. So it's not just this one. They'd then start drilling more wells on across this prospect, and it could end up being very, very substantial. I don't think the market's really got its head around just how big this could be for United Oil and Gas actually going forward. So we're very pleased with these guys, and I think they are really going to go places over the next few years. It's one to just put in the bottom drawer and leave for a couple of years, and you could be very, very well rewarded, we think. So
I've spoken to Brian, and he's got ambition there, and of course what I didn't understand is they've got that interest in Romania, sorry, in Italy as well, which looks quite good, and yet the share price came off on that.
They went down on the back of that.
I don't understand that.
well, that's the market. There's traders in there. The stocks had a good run, so they've taken their profits. But, I mean, it's a great result for the company. And we're now going to see the flow test data coming out over the next few weeks. But I know that they're very happy with what they've got. So that's great. Just demonstrates that they do know what they're doing.
They're going
to be drilling the Waddock Crosswell next year, UK onshore. And they're not going to stop there. I mean, they're continually looking for additional assets for the portfolio. They are going places. So that's good. Another one actually in that group that has actually done something interesting, which I don't think the market's really given them much reward for, is Upland Resources, and they signed that farm in with Carillion for a 40% working interest in that offshore UK license. I mean, it's offshore. It's only 2 kilometres offshore and could be drilled from the onshore. So I mean, it'd be quite an economic prospect to go for. But the P50 target there is 250 million barrels of oil. So they've got a 40% working interest in that. It's subject to the government approval, but we don't think that's going to be an issue because they've already got they've got the Hardstoff licence and they've got an option on Wrestle. So, I mean, they're well known to the UK authorities, so we don't think that'd be an issue. And that's going to be drilled, we think, back end of 2018. So, exciting prospect for Upland.
Yeah, it is. And I do hold a bit of stock in Upland. I've written a blog on them, and it's quite interesting. This time from last year, it is about November time, I chatted to Steve, and I chatted to him again this year. But this time last year, he was sort of optimistic on news, because he's got this sort of phase one, phase two strategy, where the phase one is quite sensible, near-term cash-generating assets, not too much risk, and then phase two, more risk, transformational almost could be for the company.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was close to
this time last year, but naming assets in North Africa and the Far East, and it hasn't come through. So you've got, and he said they're still on track. So you've got to think they're close as well.
Well, the Malaysian deal is still just. It hasn't gone away. I mean, it's still out there. I mean, it's just taking these things just to take a long time to negotiate. There was a disappointment this year with the Wrestle permitting, and that was the near-term cash flow. asset that they targeted, and that's sort of been put back a bit. I mean, hopefully that will go through, and that will become a near-term producing asset for the company. Yeah. But the things like the Wick prospect, which they've just farmed into, I mean, that's where Steve has really comes into his own, because he's got a very capable team. He's very capable himself, and he can identify very sizable targets. So, you know, we can go from not being very quiet to all of a sudden, you know, having something substantial. I mean, he was a director of Cove, and they went from 5p to £2.40. So, yeah. you're just never quite sure. And Steve's quite capable of doing these larger deals as well as these smaller cash flow opportunities as well. So, yeah, no, I think a better year ahead for them, I suspect.
Yeah, definitely. It's been a year of delays, but there's still, like, that Wick thing came out of nowhere, really, because I was expecting news on, like I said, North Africa and Malaysia. It didn't happen. And then there was a delay on Wrestle, but they still did the Wick thing. So I'm thinking in 2018, there could be several bits of news from Utland, because, I mean, you could have these North African or the Malaysian and Wrestle, so all sort of happening. So it could be a very exciting year for them. Okay, yeah, anything else?
I think so.
Anything else, was it?
Anything else? Well, we've got, what have we got that we've been looked at? Well, I've got something that's coming up next year, which I think fits very much into the what's happening with electric vehicles and the whole transformation that's going on, really, with lithium-ion batteries being now going to be used more and more and more as we see a conversion from combustion engines to electric vehicles. We all know that story quite well.
Yeah.
But we've been working with a company called Turapati Graphite, which is it's an Indian management team, and they have a license in Madagascar, and a graphite license. And we did a small seed financing round for them earlier this year at 10p to get things going. We're going to be doing a pre-IPO financing for them over the coming weeks, and then they're going to be looking to list on probably a standard list next year. But they will come to the market with, they've got two projects. The first one, smaller one, which they've just acquired, will be generating cash flow for them when they list. And the flagship project, the Vatamina project, will be in production later in the second quarter of next year. And they are targeting around about $12 million EBITDA in their first full year of production. And then they're going to be ramping up. I mean, they're going to start off with 22,000 tons of production, and they're going to ramp that up to 76, which point they'll be doing $30 to $40 million in EBITDA. So that is as a pretty exciting story for the market, and it's an unusual one where you've got a company that's coming to the market. It's a mining company, but it's going to be generating cash flow on listing, which I think is great for investors.
Absolutely. What are they called again, Kristen?
They're called Turapati Graphite.
Turapati, yeah. Okay.
I've actually gone on the board to represent our investors, because we've taken about a 30% interest from our investment clients at Optiva. So I'm on the board there, probably will sort of up to the listing. I like it a lot. The guys have been in the graphite industry for 20 years. They know inside out. And the, you know, demand for flake graphite is going to be pretty exponential over the next few years. But it's not just about flake graphite and going into lithium-ion batteries. There's graphite demand growth coming from fire retardants, from refractory graphite, and various other parts of the graphite market are all growing quite fast. So it's a good place for investors to be. It's going to be a bit competitive. There are going to be other companies coming onto the market during the next 2 years. So a company like this that gets its product onto the market early is going to be in a very strong position.
Yeah.
So I like that.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I just saw a graph of the demand forecast growth from electric vehicle markets. And graphite, there's all different colours here, bands, there's a bar chart. But I was looking at it across, and I thought lithium would be their massive demand. But I was looking at it, and graphite is actually the one that's growing the most demand. So it seems like about, I don't know how many tons this year, I'm trying to guess, but around about sort of, I'd say 50,000 tons this year. But by 2030, it'll be up to like 750,000 tons. So almost more than a tenfold increase in demand.
There's three times as much graphite. Well, the anode in a lithium-ion battery is all graphite.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and the cathode is where you've got the lithium and the nickel and the cobalt. So you've got a lithium-ion battery, you need graphite, and there's no real replacement for it. And you get natural graphite and you get synthetic graphite. But synthetic graphite is much more expensive than natural graphite. So the demand for natural graphite is going to just keep on growing over the next few years. And you're quite right. I mean, at the moment, there's 50 gigawatts of lithium-ion capacity out in the market. By 2025, I think that's set to be up to around 450 to 500. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it would only represent 5% of all cars on the market being electric vehicles. So the long-term demand growth, if we're going to completely replace combustion engines, is huge. We're going to need a lot more copper. We're going to need a lot more cobalt, lithium, and graphite. And nickel to supply all this, so it's a pretty exciting area for investors to play. And then you've got all the downstream potential coming through from graphite going into, you know, graphene and nanine and all these other things that are happening. So it's all pretty exciting, actually.
Yes, excellent. Well, let's hope it's a good year. I've had a good year this year, and hold a couple of those stocks you mentioned there. So let's hope it's another good year next year. Christian, good to speak to you, and let's not leave it so long next time, okay?
No, definitely. Yeah, no, pleasure to speak to you, Justin. All the best.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Connor Campbell, market analyst with Spreadex. You all right, Connor?
Very good, thank you.
All right, looking the week ahead, what's coming up? Looking at bigger companies that are reporting. So who's first? Who's up, Connor? Who's up first?
First up, we've got Dixon's Carphone on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. They've not had a very good year at all, so much so that in mid-November they're at, like, all-time lows. It's done very poorly. And unsurprisingly, really, it's like, you know, it's the kind of company that is in the firing line of Amazon and is in the UK with its terrible retail sector. So it's sort of the confluence of those two issues. Interestingly, like, its figures themselves haven't been that bad, really. Its full-year figures in June, pre-tax profit was up 10% to $501 million, which was a record figure for the company, whilst like-for-like revenue was up 4% and total revenue was up 3% to $10.5 billion. So For a stock that I think if you didn't look into it, you would think, oh, God, yeah, how could Dixon's Carphone be doing well? Those are some very, very sort of unmitigatedly healthy figures. First quarter update in August as well, its figures remained pretty solid. Like, UK like-for-likes were up 4%. In the Nordic area, they were up 8%. In Greece, they were up 6%. So total like-for-like sales were up 6%, which I think most companies in the UK, at least at the moment, would kill for that kind of like-for-like growth. However, it warned that its full-year profits would come in somewhere between $360 million and $440 million, mm-hmm. saying that currency fluctuations had made sort of mobile phone handsets more expensive, and that only like incremental technical innovations and stuff like that had sort of made people, you know, there's no like great race to upgrade your phone every time something new comes out because it's not exactly a big leap on what you currently have.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that 360 to 440 is quite a long way from the 501 million it posted the year previous. And that, you know, that sent the stock sharply lower back in August. That's sort of been the defining moment of this year, really. You know, there's a giant gap on the chart where it falls. It also said that like Dixon's Carphone tends to benefit from like series of one-off adjustments and charges each year. I think, like, for example, in its last financial year, it benefited from like £71 million worth of one-off charges and stuff. This year, however, it said that it should see a net negative charge of anywhere between £10 million and £40 million due to charges related to changes in the EU roaming legislation, mm-hmm. that are set to take hold at some point next year. Obviously, that's quite a wide band. I think in terms of its half-year figures on Wednesday, investors are going to see some kind of further clarity on that £10 million to £40 million one-off charge figure. Ideally, obviously, they'd want to see some revision to that full-year profit figure and maybe signs that it's going to be at the 440 end rather than the 360 end. Also, you know, if it can maintain that same kind of like-for-like growth that you saw in the first quarter, then maybe it can lift from its current levels. It sort of gradually climbed a bit higher since it hit those mid-November all-time lows. And we've seen sort of a smattering of clients buying the stock around 155, 160. I think perhaps testing the waters and thinking, well, it might not take a lot for Dixon's to jump if it can, you know, maintain the kind of, you know, because its like-for-like sales are very strong. If it can maintain that across the whole of the first half of the year, then maybe there's room for growth. Obviously, then the flip side is that it's in the UK retail sector, so things could have severely softened in the last few months, given the impact on, you know, the impact of inflation on real wages and things like that. But like I said, we've seen a smattering of clients buying at those lows, trying to, you know, potentially hoping for a bounce on Wednesday.
Yeah, well, I think it should, because when you think of it, this it was, you know, at the start of 2016, this was a £5 stock, you know. And now it's 166 or 160 odd.
Anything
as have they as their, you know, profits and have they halved? Is it all halved? Because if, you know, looking on a like-for-like basis or everything being equal, that's the way it should be. Even, well, sorry, more than halved, I mean, but it hasn't. So you obviously sentiment, yeah. Retail sentiment is really low, isn't it? And sometimes that can turn when it's overly done like this, overly sold, and it is on the chart. If you look at the chart there, I mean, the RSI indicator, which is, you know, it gets to oversold below 30, it went down to like 9, which is like, wow. And then it bounced back up. So it's just the sentiment towards retail at the moment is really poor, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, even if, say, if it did manage 440 million pre-tax profit, that's still nearly half a billion in pre-tax profit. Like, for a UK retailer, that is not, that's not bad by any means. It's still lower than what before, but being lower than a record year again is also not, it's not that bad. Like you said, like falling from over £5 to 155, 160 is quite a sharp drop, which I think isn't necessarily reflected in the figures that it's posted in its last two updates. And I think that, like I said, that's why we've seen clients buying at those levels.
Yeah. Well, exactly. So, there you go. Yeah. So profit after tax was 295 million. So, you know, you put that on a so P/10 times by 10. That's two billion. So they're not valued at that. They're valued at what, P of 1.9. They're just under that. So they're under that. Not far off. But they've been sold heavily. So a big sell off there. All right. So what else is next, Connor?
We've also got Purple Bricks. They're also reporting on Wednesday. Sort of an AIM market like favorite.
They're a disruptor, I suppose, aren't they, really?
They're sort of perfect for like perfect kind of AIM stock, you know, small but potentially a big player in a few years. It had like an amazing first half of the year, climbed really, really sharply, but sort of since then, since like early September, end of August, it's things have begun to become a bit trickier, really. Full year figures back in June, pre-tax profit basically halved from like 11.9 million to 6 million. It saw 150% rise in revenue to 46.7 million, which, you know, those are the kinds of figures you want from an AIM stock. It also announced that it was expanding into America, first in Los Angeles, then the rest of California. Now, sort of that has been sort of the sticking point, really, for the stock. In the first half of the year, reports and it sort of hints that it was going to expand into the US seemed to drive it higher. Yet then when it actually confirmed it was launching in the US, that sort of fell around the time the stock began to pull back a bit, as if investors had become a bit nervy about it launching into the US and maybe thinking, how has it bitten off more than it can chew at the moment? And like first quarter figures in September said it was on track to meet annual revenue forecasts of 80 million in the UK and 12 million in Australia, which is significantly higher than the year previous for both. If you look at the fact that total revenue was 46.7 million for the full year figures in June. Also said that in the US, website visits and valuations booked had exceeded both the UK and Australia at the same time in their development, which again is a positive enough update, but it didn't really do a lot for the stock. I think perhaps the fact that it didn't provide any figures alongside that maybe put investors off of getting too involved with the stock. November, it released like a pointless, really three-line update saying that it remains on course to meet the bull's expectations, which again, I think the lack of detail there probably hurt the stock more than if it just hadn't said anything at all. So I think on Wednesday, it really needs to give half your revenue figures that sort of justify those 18 million and 12 million targets for the UK and Australia respectively. And it really, I think it needs to now give a more substantial update on how it's been doing in the US, what its plans are for the US in 2018, you know, some kind of hard data for investors to work through. you know, see, well, is this expansion in the US working? Interestingly, like, it's pulled back a bit around the 350 mark. We've seen a lot of sellers around that 350 mark. I was surprised to see how many there were, actually, when I looked. I think investors are holding off for the moment, maybe until they see, you know, what the US expansion is looking like. But, yeah, a lot of sellers around that 350 mark from our clients.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you know what? Is it that ASA ruling, didn't they? The advertising, because in the I'm trying to get what it was all about, where they said there's two issues. And there was the first issue was whether TV adverts implied that Pittlebricks did not charge a fee for its service. That was dismissed by the ASA, the Advertising Standards Agency. On the second issue, the ASA agreed that it was not sufficiently clear in the TV ads that the average customer, that the flat fee was payable to Pittlebricks in all instances. So, they knew what they were doing. they said that hasn't affected business, yeah. Marvellous. Okay, anything else, Connor?
Yeah, finally, we've got Sports Direct on Thursday.
They've been in the press of late, talking about them and two agencies they use, working agencies, have been fined a total of £1.1 million for failing to pay minimum wage. And so they don't get a good press there. They don't help themselves.
No, they really don't. They don't help themselves, really.
What's happening here, Connor? What else?
Yeah, it's interesting, though. The first 6 months of the year, the stock didn't really do anything. It sort of crept up to the £3 mark and then, bar a few phrases either side of that level, that largely remained around the £3 mark for the first 6 or so months of the year. Then it released its full year figures in July, and then in the month after, I think the full year figures come out 20th of July, in around a month or a bit shy of a month after, it rose 40%, jumped from like £3 to like £4.22, which I think was like a 17 month high when it hit that in mid August. And that was mainly because of the full year figures themselves weren't exactly great. Like, revenue was up 11.7% to £3.25 billion. That's fine. But underlying pre-tax profit plunged 58% to £113.7 million, mainly due to the firm's like lack of hedging around sterling and, you know, its post-Brexit slide. The company was really caught out by that. However, Mike Ashley, so obviously it depends how much of a pinch of salt you want to take it with, but Mike Ashley said that the company would grow earnings by 5 to 15% in its next financial year, thanks to its sort of push into the upmarket. You know, if you look at their full year figures, I think the phrase Selfridges of Sport is probably used upwards of 10 times. Like, that's its new aim now. It's going to open 12 to 18 of these new generation flagship stores in 2018. I think it's aiming for 75 to 100 of those within the next 10 years. That's its new push. It wants these smart looking stores. And I think it's been successful. I think I was reading somewhere that an unnamed location, I think normally their stores see profit of around £500,000, and this unnamed, like, upmark, you know, Selfridges of Sport, whatever store, saw profit of around £2.1 million. So if that holds for all of these locations, then it's a pretty savvy move on Sports Direct's part, and it was something that investors clearly bought into, given just how sharply it rose between mid-July and mid-August, basically on the back of those comments from Mike Ashley. September's latest statement didn't really do much. It said it remains optimistic, in line with sort of the 5 to 15% rise in underlying earnings forecast it put forward in July. Though optimistic, I guess, isn't necessarily the same as saying that it's on track. So I think that might explain partly why it's pulled back since those mid-August highs. Also, that September statement came on the same day as its AGM, which again saw the latest sort of shareholder revolt over Keith Hellerwell's position as chairman. So I think perhaps investors got distracted by that than the update in September. In terms of its half-year figures on Thursday, it's sort of a bit like Purplebricks. It needs to show that it's actually on track to deliver that the growth in underlying earnings, because it's all right saying that it's optimistic, but investors are going to want to see figures that prove it can, obviously ideally see at the 15% end of it, but at bare minimum hitting that 5% growth promise back in July. I think also investors are going to want to see, well, how well are these upmarket new stores doing? How many has it opened in the 6 months since July? You know, has the store, you know, it's pushing into that market, but has that been hit by, you know, the squeeze on real wages that has been seen in the last few months? Like, it's all very well and good that Sports Direct pushing into that realm, but I guess a bit like Primark, it was seen as a cheap stock, and that was one of its shop to go and buy stuff at, and that was maybe one of its benefits.
Yeah.
So in this shifting UK retail landscape where firms like Primark might come out okay because they're so much cheaper than their rivals, is it the wrong time for them to be moving into the upmarket arena, really? From my client's perspective, they still seem on board with the stock. They seem convinced by what Mike Ashley said back in July. They've been buying around that 380 mark. Not in great droves. There are a few sellers here and there, but enough buyers to suggest that they're willing to give Ashley the benefit of the doubt and hold out for that 5-15% growth in underlying earnings.
Yeah, well, like Primark as well, they're the other company that's been highlighted for not paying the minimum wage. And Primark, it was due to, they had to pay people back, about £231,000, pay workers back because they made workers buy their own uniform, which to earn his
debt. There is a sort of moral dark side to those very, very cheap companies.
Yeah, the moral dark. That's why I don't feel clean investing in those companies, you know, because it's like you're trying to earn money off people that are going through a heck of a bad time earning, you know, substandard wage and finding it hard to just get make a living.
Especially something like Sports Direct that is repeatedly on the wrong side of any ethical line, but in the news. Yeah. It never really affects its stock price. It's always other issues, like just poor management rather than its bad working practices and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Marvellous. Connor, thanks for that. And I'm not here next week. I'm away. So have a nice week. But in fact, I'm not back the week after, actually. So maybe back on the Friday if you're still around. So maybe we'll have a call the week after next, all right?
Oh, cool. Sounds good. Thanks. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.